The Orange FM.
Ready to form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Infracell up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. And I'm here again with Mike French. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
Great. All right, so, you know, something really cool happened this week. We got something in the mail, and I'm going to let you talk about it. Any other things that are going on at WEP right now?
Yeah, well, first of all, as you mentioned, the 30th anniversary diecast Toynami Voltrons have started shipping from overseas, and I believe the people who pre-ordered them have been getting them already, which is exciting. And the next batch, of course, is going to be hitting the shores, I believe, sometime in June or maybe even before if we all get lucky, and those can be ordered now. But people seem to really be enjoying the 30th anniversary Voltron. Beautiful piece. Glowing eyes, you know, electronic sounds, display base, lion blades. It's just, it's an awesome, awesome collectible if you're a Voltron fan. And then, of course, we also have the new issue from Dynamite Comics of Robotech Voltron. Robotech Voltron number 3 just came out last week or the week before, April 23rd, I believe. And the cover is very dynamic. It's got Max Sterling looking behind him in the Veritech fighter as a highly modified Black Lion defends him against an alien bogey. It's really, really cool looking cover. And it's a great, great story that Tommy Yoon has been rolling out. People seem to really be happy with the contents inside. So I'm really glad to see that this story is taking off because it is the ultimate mecha mashup. So if you haven't read that, you can actually get a 3-issue bundle to catch up with that on the Voltron store, or you can download those issues digitally from Comixology.
Yeah, I noticed on the Voltron store that they started offering it as a 3-issue bundle.
Yep. And that's going to be a 5-issue series.
Okay. All right. And then I also wanted to say, hey, my son and I got our 30th anniversary Voltron.
Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. It's the first time I ever had any of these diecast models or anything. So it's exciting to open the package and actually take them out one by one. And my son just, he's got, you know, like all this awesomeness in his eyes that he can't wait to start playing with them. And I have to say the packaging just... It blew me away, you know.
Oh, yeah. The packaging is inspired directly from the original Japanese Chogokins. It's the suitcase style with the handle on top and then the screen tray with the styrofoam beds for all the lions. It's awesome. It is truly a throwback / tribute to 30 years of Voltron, Go Lion, Sentai anime greatness.
Right. And I'm very carefully taking these out of the styrofoam because I don't want to, you know, break any parts of the styrofoam and everything because what happens if I actually want to transport this and put everything back in its case and everything. So I was being very careful about that. And then, you know, once I started putting together Voltron into the robot form, it was really, really cool. And then the light up eyes. And it's got that little plastic piece that cuts the connection so it won't light up when you keep it stored.
Right.
And then, you know, then obviously the base with each of the lion's mouth weapons that you can put around the outside of the base.
Mm-hmm.
And then the shield and the blazing sword. And it's got it's a stand for the shield and the sword.
Right.
So if you're using it in lion form where you've just got them out as all the different lions, you can hang up the blazing sword and the shield.
Exactly. Yeah, you have a lot of different display options with this one. It's really slick the way they put it all together. And you know, you could have the black lion on the center of the stand, you know, with his one blade, and then the other lions, you know, sort of displayed out around him, fanned out. And then the sword and shield in the background. There's just a lot of cool options for it. And of course, the key that activates the sound effects. I mean, it's a really, really slick piece. And I think it's a marked upgrade from the 20th anniversary, which was nice enough on its own. So for those of you who already have the 20th anniversary, there's a lot here in the 30th anniversary version that is highly recommended.
Yeah, and this whole key sequence, okay, when you're putting in the key, it comes with a badge, all right? So it's just like when the mice showed us the key for the first time in The Missing Key. And you see that, and you can take that clip part of the badge off. And then you've got the key that you put in the slot on the base, and then you slide it in and it locks in and it makes the sounds. And that sound is the same sound as the first time Voltron formed in the Missing Key.
Right.
And we're going to talk about that because we talked about those first four episodes before. And now we're going to finish The Missing Key, and then we're going to go into the next three or four episodes, right?
Right.
Okay, so getting back to The Missing Key then.
Yep.
And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
All right, so the mice bring the key to the Voltron force and Karan and the princess, and all of a sudden, Zarkon attacks.
Which he is apt to do.
Right. And they go to the control room, and they're seeing all this stuff happening on the screens, and they're just, you know, in shock again. But Sven says, hey, what are we doing just waiting around? Let's get to work. So Keith says, let's go. And Karan says, well, wait, it's dangerous. You've never tried it before.
Right.
And Keith is like, oh, come on. This is what we're here to do.
Right. Right. There's an interesting dynamic there with Karan and the pilots that, you know, like his name in Golion is Rybel. He's the castle strategist. And there's this contentious push-pull relationship with them in both Voltron and Golion. And Golion, it's certainly more marked because he's much more harsh with them. And like he wants them to be these heroes, but at the same time, there's this, it's almost like xenophobia. He's got this distrust of people who aren't from Eris. Not Karan so much in Voltron, but in Golion on Altea, he really doesn't trust non-Alteans. So they even call him out at times. They're like, wait a second, you want us to be these pilots that fly Golion? You brought us in and told us we were these heroes, and you've tested us, and now you're turning around and telling us we can't fly Golion. And it's an interesting dynamic,
right? And he says he's only thinking about their safety. And Keith's like, well, none of us are safe while we just stand here and get hit with these lasers.
Right, right. Yeah.
So the princess ends up, you know, coming in, just please go now. We need Voltron. And they just all cheer, yay.
Right.
And then they head for the lions.
Which, you know, is what we've been waiting to see for 3.5 episodes. So, you know, when you're a kid and you're sitting there, it's a good build.
Yeah.
You know, it's been worth it.
And they really take advantage of this extended sequence where they show the pilots entering the lions and the keys locking in. And like I said, it's just like the Toynami 30th anniversary Voltron, just like it.
Right. Exactly. It's that sequence that captured our imaginations and has held us here and is why we're doing podcasts and watching new cartoons. And yeah, it's an amazing sequence, which is why I'm glad it's in almost every episode.
Right. Now Urak comes in and he says, those lions again, I thought the Robies destroyed them. They must have 9 lives.
Right.
So every once in a while he gets a good line in.
Yeah, Urak is definitely one of those forgotten characters that had a substantial role in the original run of Voltron episodes, that first miniseries. And people remember Lotor more because Lotor came in and succeeded him. But Urak actually has a lot of interesting character traits going on. He's like this guy that I envision as this seasoned general who's worked for Zarkon a long time, but now he's just gotten to that point in his career where he just can't make a good decision. And it's like he had a great run, but now it's just this slippery slope into being fired. So
yeah. And now the Robeast is supercharged, and this is the second appearance of this Robeast.
Mm-hmm.
So the lions attack it, and they're just bouncing off of it, and they try to jump and bite its arm, and they're just getting thrown off of it.
Right.
All right, with the Robeast, he has a sword.
Yep.
All right, and he uses these heat blasts from his arms, too, to attack. So now they're getting here, and Keith says, we need Voltron.
Mm-hmm.
So Keith's words, they start off with, get ready to assemble. And I'm just going to play that part because it's the first time. All right?
Okay.
Get ready to assemble. Activate interlock. Dinotherms.
What's interesting here is that the opening sequence isn't like the opening sequence we know now.
Sure.
It started off with activate, interlock, dinotherms connected, and they go right to Voltron.
Well, it's many television shows, as you know, they take a few episodes, some of them even take a few seasons, like in the case of The Simpsons, to find their footing. And Voltron's famous sequence was no different. I'm sure they finessed it, played with it, and modified it to provide maximum impact. But that first episode that they had to do it, they were feeling their way through.
Well, as you know, the very first episode that we did of this podcast, the opening music that we have at the beginning, we didn't have Let's Voltron, Let's Voltron, Let's Voltron as the first time. So, we worked it out that we said, hey, we want to have Let's Voltron as part of this. And we added that in. And then by the second episode, we had that in there.
Right.
And it's been there ever since.
It's all these creative processes, they evolve. And Voltron is no different. But that's good that it evolved because it means they wanted to improve it and make it perfect. So
Right. So Voltron is formed for the first time. And the first time the Robeast attacks, Voltron grabs the arm and throws him down. And we're like, all right, we've got Voltron. We're gonna defeat this Robeast. But then the Robeast attacks with missiles, and it doesn't seem to affect Voltron that much. His heat lasers seem to have no effect on Voltron either. And we're thinking, wow, we've got this powerful robot. So they say Voltron form blazing sword. And you see a really cool part here is the sword that the Robeast is holding, you see Voltron's reflection in that Robeast sword. I thought that was a really cool effect for.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, that's one of those little things, much like, there are other little moments in Voltron like that. Like there are, within these first eight episodes, there are rack focuses where the foreground is in focus and the background is not, and then suddenly the background comes into focus with animation on it and the foreground element is thrown out of focus. These are things that you didn't see commonly in other Saturday morning / weekday afternoon cartoons back then. Like you didn't, even in the newly produced ones, like they didn't do stuff like that very often in G.I. Joe or Transformers, but in Voltron they had this kind of stuff going on, and I think it adds a real cinematic element to it. It really puts it above the other shows.
Yeah, I agree with you on that completely. All right, so They charge at each other and hit swords. Voltron jumps over him and then comes down with Blazing Sword right down the middle, and it explodes. And they just say, way to go, team, and then that's the end of the episode. And they show scenes for the next episode.
It's his signature move.
Yeah. As we're going to find out, yeah.
Right.
All right, so let's move on to episode 5, Princess Joins Up.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
In this episode, we're starting at Castle Doom, and Zarkon is furious. He wants Voltron destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
He tells Hagar, now Voltron's stronger than ever. He wants the Voltron force eliminated, and he wants Hagar to bring the princess to him.
Right.
Why do you think that is? What's the thought process around bringing the princess?
My theory, this is just my own personal theory, but, you know, if you read Sun Tzu's The Art of War, my whole take on it is that he assumed the royal family was dead. So if there's still a leader down there for the Arusians to rally behind, then he wants that person taken out of the equation. And in this case, he's thinking, and this is just me conjecturing, but maybe he's thinking that the princess has information about Voltron. You know, rather than eliminate her outright, like what happened to Alphor, he's like, this is an opportunity to get her, bring her here as a political prisoner, and get the information about Voltron that we want.
All right, I can see that. I can see that because he thought getting rid of Alphor was going to probably get rid of Voltron, and right. He didn't realize that this was a secret that could be passed down. And, you know, I guess he didn't count on the ghost of Alphor coming through to them to let them know how to do it either.
Yeah, I can't even remember if there's any point in the series where he's aware that Alphor is still around in an ethereal way. I'm trying to remember if there's ever a moment where he learns that Alphor is still giving them information through the beyond.
I think Hagar is the one that tells him that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're going to get to a part here where Hagar actually talks about that.
Okay, good.
So, so basically, he's asking Hagar for help here. Hagar promises to turn his best gladiator into a monster stronger than Voltron.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to have to go through the arena, and Voltron will trouble you no more, sire. You know, the robot gladiators report to the arena to fight, and the winner will be sent to destroy Voltron. At this point, they're showing some of the Drool warriors or soldiers, and they're all questioning on how the witch will work her magic to make a beast worthy to defeat Voltron.
Right.
So even the Drool warriors don't know, you know, how this is going to work. And then meanwhile, they show some of the slaves that are still, you know, trapped on planet Doom. And the slaves hear how Voltron has returned, and they remark it was the space explorers that escaped from planet Doom that formed Voltron. And they think if he was able to defeat Zarkon's robot Robeast, he might come to rescue them, and Voltron is their only hope to escape from Zarkon.
Right. And that's very similar in Golion, where there's now talk of, you know, we heard the Earthlings who escaped have found Golion, and they've, you know, torn up Daibazal's Death Black Beastmen, and which are the Robeasts. And, we thought that the Earthlings were insects, but they're actually formidable, you know, enemies of the Drools, the Galra. And it's funny because all of the what you don't see in Voltron is the retaliation by the slave drivers, where they, you know, punch them with maces and hit them with whips and all sorts of stuff to stop the unrest, to stop the whole the beginnings of dissension, the beginnings of doubt in Zarkon's absolute power.
Yeah, and later on, we talk about how Voltron is only a defender, and he doesn't attack.
Right.
Okay, so the chances of them actually going to Doom to attack Zarkon is pretty limited at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Unless something forces them to go to Doom. And, you know, at that point, I don't even know if they're thinking, oh, by the way, we have to free all the slaves there on Doom.
Right.
You know, because I think what they're thinking is just get over the task at hand and then return back and continue to defend Aris and the rest of the universe.
Exactly.
So I don't know if these guys actually know, you know, just how long they're in there for.
You talking about the slaves?
The slaves.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's, you know, they're already in this situation. That's their reality. So I would think that the anticipation of a possible rescue would be excruciating. You know, it's like, right. You know, maybe you should stop thinking about that and just keep breaking rocks because you have no idea when this is going to happen. You're just torturing yourself.
Right. All right. So the Robeast Gladiators are fighting in the arena, and I just want to say this for the record. I don't really think any of them look like robot gladiators.
They're not.
No. And that's the whole thing about going from Beast King Goline to Voltron. You're trying to convince me that these are robot gladiators, but they don't look like robots.
Yeah, and even when I picked up before the Goline DVDs had ever come out, I picked up the original Voltron DVDs in the tin sets, and I took them home. I hadn't seen that show in 20 years, and I put it in, and I was like, wait a second, these things don't look very robotic. I wonder if something's going on here with clever editing. You know, like, this seems like these were living things in some different incarnation of this series. And sure enough, when you see Beast King Golion, that fight is brutal. Those things are getting dissected and maimed and cut in half, and blood's flying everywhere, and people are getting their throats cut. And
right.
It's intense.
Right, and blood doesn't come out of a robot.
Right.
So they finally get a winner out of all this, and Hagar uses her magic crystal ray to make a gladiator that is invincible, and they leave in the space coffin.
Yes, and in Golion, that gladiator is known as Death Hell. Zarkon names him after he wins the arena fight. He says, "You shall now be known as Death Hell."
Wow.
And you will defeat Golion. Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
Wow, I'm glad we didn't get that on the Voltron form.
Yeah. And then, of course, when Hagar, Hinerva, when she turns him into the Robeast in the Golion version, first she says, "I'm going to bathe you in the fires of hell, withstand it, survive it." And then she says, "And then I will hit you with the lightning of hell," or something like that. "Withstand it. Your body must withstand this, and you will become super powerful." Like, it's very dark. It's very esoteric and very dark.
Yep. All right, so after we leave Doom, we go back to Aris, and the Voltron Force is trying to convince the people of Aris to come out of their caves and help defend Aris against another attack from Zarkon.
Right.
The people really aren't willing to come out.
No.
You know, of course, Keith tells Lance, well, who's to blame them and all that kind of stuff. You know, they've been through so much. But at this point, they're still not really convinced that it's okay for them to come out.
And you know what? Given what happens in subsequent episodes, they're probably right.
Right. And of course, they have to go back to the princess, tell her the bad news. Okay, there's no one to help. And Hunk says something to her, and he says, "It's too bad we can't use Voltron to attack Zarkon before he attacks us." And this is where she says, "Voltron's the defender of the universe, and he is never to be used for attack."
Right.
So that kind of sets the stage for, you know, what it's going to be like for the whole, you know, series.
Which is a very different idea, you know, because in Golion, he's just this weapon. And what restrains him to Aris is not so much his own inherent purpose, but more the restraints from Koran. This is Aris's weapon. This is our defender. This is not something for you to go risk losing in a war somewhere else. And so that's kind of how that builds in the original Japanese show.
Okay. So at this point, they're on the top of the castle and Zarkon attacks.
Right.
So they start ducking for cover, and then they head down into the control room, and They launched the Lions, and for the first time, they used their mouth weapons. For the first time, they used their mouth weapons, and Urek brings out the Robeast.
Right.
All right. So they start firing laser blasts and biting him, and none of that's working. And they're like pesky little flies to him. So they assemble Voltron. The Robeast attacks with double swords. And then he's got extending spikes that actually, at one point, goes through Yellow Lion.
Uh-huh.
And then they form Blazing Sword. And they both fall down into a canyon. And at this point, Princess says something like, "Try isotopic missiles."
Right.
This is the first time I've ever called them, you know, the missiles any type of name. And that doesn't work. So the space mice tell the princess that there's an attack on the castle that's coming from Urak's forces.
Uh-huh.
So Urak's attacking the castle now, and Karan suggests that they surrender. He doesn't see a way out of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, Robeast has Voltron, and Voltron's not making any headway with that. Urek's forces are attacking the castle, and the castle's fallen apart. But the princess refuses. As long as the castle stands, Eris stands, she says.
You know, in Golion, just to give you sort of a foil, not to be so broken record about the whole thing, but it is interesting to see these parallels. In Golion, the princess is told by Karan that she needs to flee. He's told, "You need to get out of here." And she says, "No, I'm going to stay here and fight this out with my people. I can't leave. You know, if they see me leave, then what is all this for?" And he's stunned, you know, and worried. You know, in regards to the Voltron thing about Karan wanting to surrender, it's something that adds drama to the whole sequence, because Karan has seen the war before. He saw Eris fall. He saw Alfor die. He saw all these things happen. And I don't think mentally he can tolerate it happening again. You know, he probably psychologically is at a point where he's just like, you know what? I'd rather just give up than go through all this death again. That's my take on it.
Yeah, and I can see from a writer's standpoint, to increase the drama, you sort of have to have the characters say something that you wouldn't, that the viewer might not think they would say.
Right.
Like, no, nobody gives up. What are you talking about?
Right.
You know, and to have them say that, it takes you back a second. It's, why would you say that?
Yeah, what are you doing?
And it really makes the viewer think, you know, mm-hmm. Wow, I can't even believe they'd go to the point where they think about surrendering.
But yeah.
I guess they really think their backs are against the wall, and maybe I should think that too.
Yep.
You know, so when the princess says she wants to fight, okay, well, how's that going to happen? And what we find out is the Robeast knocks Blazing Sword right out of Voltron's hand. And you and I had talked about this before, the reason why just forming Blazing Sword and swiping down the Robeast doesn't always work.
Right.
So he knocks it out of Voltron's hand. It's sticking in the dirt somewhere. And then he holds Voltron and keeps him from protecting the castle. And at this point, Princess goes to her father's tomb to seek guidance, because that's the only thing she can think of at this point.
Right.
So King Alfor tells her to touch the center of his crown and she will be victorious. And what ends up happening is the castle ends up, you know, erupting out of there into a whole new castle. It looks all metal and looks really shiny and everything. And it rises out of the rubble and the old castle's gone. And there's nothing but this new castle there. And it's an amazing, you know, thing to see. And Karan's just as surprised as everyone else, you know.
Right.
So the princess grabs one of the turrets on the side of the castle and starts firing at the Robeast and Urek's ships.
Which is pretty awesome.
And then from that point on, I mean, it's just 1, 2, 3. Voltron's able to destroy the Robeast. And now the princess has joined the team in the fight.
You know, the real odd thing about that from a continuity perspective in that whole sequence of events, have you ever wondered why Karan doesn't know about the second castle underneath, but later on he does know that that castle turns into a spaceship Like he knew that the whole time.
Right.
He's like, oh, by the way, everybody, this castle turns into a spaceship. And everyone's like, whoa, really? And he's like, yeah, yeah, I knew it the whole time. It's like, what? You didn't even know there was a castle under there. How did you know that?
Right. Well, you know, maybe something happened between the time that he found out there was a castle and, you know, maybe he was able to confer with King Alfor at one point. You know, I don't know. You know, maybe these things happen behind the scenes and we never saw it.
I guess.
All right, so that ends that episode. And now we move to episode 6.
Uh-huh.
The Right Arm of Voltron.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
Now, when you saw the title, The Right Arm of Voltron, what were you thinking?
Well, I mean, you know, you naturally think Red Lion. You think about Lance, and you think about, you know, the Blazing Sword and all that kind of stuff. It's not, it defies your expectations, in other words.
Right, right. In heading to this episode, we're wondering what's going to happen. Is it going to be something that involves Red Lion?
Mm-hmm.
So at the beginning, some of Varys' people come to the new castle, and because they saw it rise out of the rubble, and you know, they know that Voltron and the princess defeated, you know, Urak's forces and the Robeast. And the princess tells the people they are protected by Voltron and they want to celebrate with a feast. So, you know, Pidge, Lance, and Hunk, they get this special time where there's I don't know, a little bit of a lighthearted moment because they find the secret storage room of food that the princess has been planning for this day, this long-awaited day where they're actually going to be able to celebrate, you know, defeating Zarkon's forces.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the space mice are there, too. And in the beginning, Pidge doesn't want to let them get to the food, but then he says, hey, you know, what the heck? You guys are heroes, too. You got us the missing key.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a nice lighthearted moment, but, of course, those all end with Zarkon attacking again.
Right.
And of course, Urak's there, and they have to go to the lions. And Urak wants them destroyed before they can form Voltron this time. But they succeed in forming Voltron. So at the end of all this, they say, Voltron ready. And then they say, form Blazing Sword. And they go after Urak's ship. And they hit Urak's ship, and it's just like that. Urak's defeated, and he retreats to Planet Doom. It was the shortest battle in history, I think.
Well, you mean this is the one where they knocked them into the lava, right?
No. At this point, it was just, you know, Urak came with a ship, and he didn't come with a Robeast.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, there was no Robeast involved here. He was just attacking. I don't know why. You know, what made him think that he was going to be able to defeat Voltron and you know, Aris all by himself without a Robeast this time. So, have no idea where Urak came from on this.
Well, again, like we talked about earlier, Urak is starting to make bad decisions. It's just, you know, the best days of his career are over. And, and it's obvious that it's time for him to hang it up.
Right. So, you know, at this point, they get to have their victory feast. And on Planet Doom, Zarkon's just yelling at Urak. So Hagar has to come up with a new scheme. So her idea is, let's take one of the Voltron force away, and then they can't form Voltron.
Right.
And she doesn't care who it is. She just wants to take one of them away.
Uh-huh.
So she's going to get this other robot gladiator that she knows. And they're both going to go to Aris, and then they're going to try to somehow, you know, take out one of the Voltron force.
Right.
Here's what happens next. We see a scene with the galaxy garrison. They know Zarkon is going to attack Aris again. They have sources that have told them that.
Right.
They have to warn them on Aris, but the problem is that meteor showers are preventing them from communicating. They know that the Voltron force and the people of Aris are planning on celebrating with a feast and that they feel safe now with Voltron, but they just hope that Voltron can form and stop the attack again.
Right.
So at this point, we hadn't heard from the Galaxy Garrison for a while, so it was nice that they threw that in there to let us know. They're still there. The Galaxy Alliance is still there. While the first few episodes are happening here, and we've got Voltron back to defend Eris. Yes, the Galaxy Alliance still has to worry about Zarkon and his forces, but Eris is the one that's getting pummeled, most of the time.
Right.
So I thought it was a good, insert here to have the Galaxy Garrison come in.
Yeah, it continues to establish that universe. It helps maintain that sense of scope, because we've been separated from the Galaxy Garrison for a few episodes now, ever since they had that discussion about not wanting to send help to the Voltron pilots. And we need to be reminded that the Space Explorers are not acting autonomously. Like, there is a mission that they're on, and they were sent by a larger entity. And that just helps continue to maintain the Voltron continuity, the whole universe, and give it that scope that it needs.
There were times when I was hoping that we'd be able to see the Galaxy Garrison actually communicating with them at the control center or something like that. But they had something in there that showed that they couldn't communicate with the meteor showers and everything.
Right, right.
At this point, the people on Eris are still in their caves, and the Voltron force is trying to share some food with them around a ruined city. And while they're distracted, Hagar's cat gets their attention.
Yes, Hagar's cat.
Yeah. And Lance goes after it, and Sven is following him close, not wanting him to go by himself. So Hagar traps Lance in a net that she gets from her staff. And Sven uses his sword to cut Lance out. And he tells him to get help and takes on Hagar by himself. And of course, she's like, well, I don't care who I get. I just need to get one of you guys. But she surrounds him with holographic copies of herself and starts spinning around Sven.
Yep.
I wanted to know from you in the Golion episodes, is this sequence changed at all?
Not up until this moment. He does tell Lance, you gotta, or Kurogane, he says, you gotta go get help. And so Kurogane takes off, and Sven, Shirogane, he faces off against the witch, Hinerva. And when she starts duplicating herself, there's this interesting narration where they talk about how Sven is now unable to use his eyes, meaning he can't trust what he sees with his eyes, so he has to go into his inner mind's eye to determine which one Hinerva, which one is actually Hagar. It's kind of a cool idea, he's in this Zen state to try and figure out through like a warrior's focus where she is, and he closes his eyes. It's a very Star Wars style moment, with the blast shield down, I can't even see, how am I supposed to fight? Your eyes can deceive you, don't trust them. And Sven does that, where he, he's like, I don't trust my eyes, so I'm going to trust my inner abilities.
To me, it reminded me of the moment where, and I'm going to bring back another moment from a movie you didn't like.
Okay.
Remember at the end of The Phantom Menace?
Boo!
When Darth Maul is fighting both Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon.
Uh-huh.
And at one moment, Qui-Gon, he just sits down and starts to meditate. And it's before the shield is opened again so that he can attack.
Right.
And this is just before he goes to fight Darth Maul again.
Mm-hmm.
And when he fights Darth Maul, he gets defeated.
Right.
And, he was in that meditative state, bringing himself at peace and so he could fight better. And the same thing happens with Sven, where, he gets down, he gets that calmness where it basically takes away all those extra copies of Hagar, and he's able to go after her.
Right.
At that point, he attacks her, and then the cat bites him.
Uh-huh.
And then the Robeast hits him, and he's knocked down, and it looks like he's either unconscious or dead, and we don't know which.
Well, first I'm going to say that what we should be saying is that Phantom Menace ripped off this episode of Voltron to do that, rather than the other way around. And okay. Then because that was 15 years. No, yeah, 15 years later.
Right.
Yeah, the in Golion, this scene is markedly more brutal because Hagar's cat attacks him. He falls to his knees, and then he's hit in the back of the head by the roe beast and falls to his knees. And he's bleeding from the top of his head, and then of course the roe beast comes up to his body while he's laying there on the ground, and he can't really move, and he's suffering. And the roe beast pulls one of those spiked arms and just stabs him right between the shoulder blades, like just in his back. And that's when he's just like, and then at that point they quickly retreat because they feel like they've accomplished their goal. And that's when Keith and Lance come running in and see their friend. And it's a much more intense moment because there's no question that this guy is about to leave this world. There's no hospital planet or infirmary for him to go to.
Right.
Yeah.
In the regular Voltron, when Keith and Lance get there, it's pretty much too late to do anything to stop Hagar and the roe beast. But Sven is hurt bad. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing they care about.
Right. Right.
And Keith says there's a doctor on planet Ebb that can help.
Right.
All right. Are there no doctors on Eris?
Well, Eris is first of all, in Golion, they play it up as a mortal wound. Like he's been stabbed, through the spine. They don't get specific, but you can see where the roe beast kind of, was bringing that spike down on him.
Yeah.
And Eris is a... Aside from the lions, they don't have an immediate way off of Eris. It's Eris is like Mad Max at this point. There's no it's a post-apocalyptic world that's crawling back out of desolation. So there aren't really medical facilities to speak of. I mean, I'm sure they have them at the castle, but the whole idea is that he's bleeding out. Like there's no way to get him anywhere. He's a goner. So.
Well, at this point, Sven is talking, and he says, "Get me there fast. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to help you form Voltron."
Right.
And then here's what they show, something that looks like it happened in both episodes. His sword, which was stuck in the ground, falls.
Uh-huh.
Now, to me, that signifies soldier's done. He's fallen.
Right.
You're not getting him back.
Right, exactly.
That's what it always signified to me. If a sword that was standing in the ground pretty firmly just all of a sudden just falls, that's a sure sign.
Sure.
But it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So the roe beast gets energized into a large roe beast, and Hagar tells him to level the castle because she thinks, they're not going to be able to form Voltron, so this is our best chance at defeating them. And the rest of the team take to the lines without Sven, and they attack the roe beast.
Right.
And at one point, they seem to be attacking it, and then realizing they're not getting where, they start to run away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And they run right towards the edge of a cliff that goes down into a lava pit.
Right.
So they're near the lava pit. Lance has a plan. They lure the roe beast to the edge. Lance attacks the head with the red line, and the other lines can push him over into the lava pit. And it's okay if Red Lion goes into the lava pit too, because he's the heat lion. He's the one that can withstand it all.
Right.
He has a den in a volcano, so he can take it.
Right.
So they do it, and Red Lion comes back out of the lava. The team defeated it without even forming Voltron.
Yep.
So I think we know now why it was called what it was called.
the right arm of Voltron?
Right.
Well, see, the reason that I brought up why that was confusing is because in the end of the Golion episode where they have Sven's funeral, Keith, or Kogane in Golion, he says that Shirogane was his friend and the right hand of their team, and he feels like he's lost his right hand. And so for the Voltron episode to be called the right arm of Voltron is kind of weird in that sense, because in Golion, it's the loss of Sven, who is described by Keith in the Japanese as his right hand. So even though you want to say in that moment, like a riff tracks or something, you want to go, you mean his right leg?
Yeah.
And it's like, no. He means his right hand, because Sven's role in the team dynamic is much more nuanced. And you can tell that he and Keith are very close friends within that grouping, within that five pilot group. And so the loss of Sven for him personally has far-reaching impact.
Right.
So.
Right. Of all the five, okay, uh-huh. With Pidge being, you know, the boyish one, and the scientific one, and Hunk being the brute force strength guy, and Lance being the guy that just tells it like it is all the time. He's not very diplomatic, you know.
Right.
And his anger gets the best of him. And then Sven, he's of all those Voltron Force, he's probably the second one out of Keith that would be the most in command.
Right.
All the time.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's pretty cool. All right, so we're going to move into episode 7.
Oh, before we move into episode 7, can I say one more thing?
What's that?
Now that you've got me thinking about it, if you don't mind.
Oh, that's okay.
There's a moment, and I don't know why I didn't mention this before. I guess it's because we were focused on another element of that story. But there's a moment where an episode back where it's about an episode back where they fight the double sworded Roe Beast, and then the castle comes out of the ground.
Right.
The princess is trying to give the pilots advice on how to fight this thing. She's very scared, and Sven gets on the monitor, and he chastises the princess actively. Like he says, you know, you're not doing us any good. Just shut up and pray for us or something. And then when the castle is attacked, there's this very interesting moment where everyone says the castle. They're like, the castle. Oh no, the castle. You know, they see it going down. They see it blowing up. And Sven doesn't say the castle. Sven yells, the princess.
Wow.
And I always found that very interesting, because then when he dies, of course, and the dynamic changes, you know, Keith, of course, becomes the more romantic interest for the princess. And Sven in Golion and in Voltron was never really around long enough for that to be defined. But there's this interesting idea that I always walked away with, which was the princess liked Keith, but Sven liked the princess.
That's probably true. When they were getting attacked on the top of the castle the one time, he was the first one to protect her.
Right.
So
it's very interesting and subtle.
Yeah.
But it's still subtle in Go Lion, but less so when he yells the princess. And then he dies. And, of course, she takes over as Lion, which is also interesting.
But then later on in the series, he ends up getting involved with someone who looks sort of like her, right?
Well played, Mark. Well played.
Yeah.
And, of course, in Go Lion, that's not him at all. That's his brother. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we go to episode 7. The mm-hmm. Lion Has New Claws.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
We start on Doom again, and Zarkon's furious. None of my wishes were carried out. So Hagar says, one of the forces disabled. They won't be able to form Voltron. Now we'll attack Aris, and they have no Voltron to defend them.
Right.
Well, on Aris, it's nighttime. A new character joins the story, coming up to the castle on a boat, and the alarm goes off. And Keith gets the team up from sleep, and Hunk goes back to sleep, and the visitor just walks in, and at this point they see an image walking down the corridor, and Pidge attacks and knocks the stranger down. Well, it's a girl. It's a woman. And she identifies herself as the royal governess.
Uh-huh.
It's Nanny. Karan sees her and asks why she's there, and she says she came when she heard that Voltron was back. Well, she doesn't like how Pidge attacked her first.
Right.
Without asking who she was. And she thinks she needs to teach them all some manners. So Karan asks her to help Princess, and she agrees.
Uh-huh.
All right, so they get away from the nanny because the nanny really wants to come after them and teach them some manners at this point. But the alarm goes off again. And this time they get hung up. Someone is in the Blue Lion. Who could it be?
It's probably Urak.
I mean, they're all sitting there trying to figure out who it is, and then they hear a scream coming over the comlink. And they find out it's the princess. So what's the princess doing in Blue Lion?
Well, I could tell you, you know, from a Voltron perspective, it's her trying to make sure that she continues to protect her people by ensuring that Voltron is impeded as briefly as possible. There's something a little bit more complex going on in Golion, where she feels a sense of obligation to take this on because, you know, she's got this sense of duty as the royal leader of Altea, and Golion was partly her father's, and so she feels like she has to play a role, and that's where the conflict begins, of course, with Nanny and Karan.
And I think in Voltron, the whole idea is that she's trying to learn how to pilot Blue Lion to help them form Voltron because that's their best chance of defending Eris.
Right.
And, of course, Nanny tells the team to go get her and bring her back. Mm-hmm. So they all go to the Lions.
Right.
Well, the princess, of course, because she has never piloted a Lion before, she's making all kinds of mistakes. So as the Lions are out there, Keith tells her, hit the red switch, and she's able to level off. And then she sort of crashes the Lion. The Lion stops.
Uh-huh.
And she passes out.
Right.
So maybe she's not as strong as she thought she was. I don't know. But she wakes up in her own bed.
Yes.
And she wants to get back in the Lion right away. And Karan stops her. I mean, physically stops her. And he says her place is in the castle. And she peels with him to let go. The nanny appears and she just starts spanking her.
Right.
You know, and to the others, this is such a spectacle that they can't help but laugh. You know, to see a grown woman being spanked.
Well, you know, I'm sure on some level it would be hilarious.
Yeah.
Although I would imagine that certain other people would have would take umbrage with that. So
yeah, of course. So the princess is pleading with them to let her pilot Blue Lion, and the nanny, she mentions that there's some men on Crown Mountain that are worthy of maybe being the successor to Sven, and that she's going to make the trip to Crown Mountain to find Sven's replacement.
Right. That's correct. And there's something else about Nanny that's I would think that Nanny is probably not on many fan favorite lists of characters in Voltron, and I can assure you that in Golion she's on even fewer. Her name's Nanny Hiss, HYS.
Wow.
And she is she brings in an element that Karan only starts to kind of hint at before her arrival. There is a heavy element in Golion of class structure and elitism within the Altean social system.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned Karan's xenophobia towards the Earth pilots. Well, Nanny Hiss takes it to another level in that scene where she's introduced. She is appalled that these non-Altean, non-royals are not only allowed in the palace, allowed to speak to the princess, but are also allowed to pilot Golion.
Okay.
And this becomes a running thing throughout the series where they are constantly being told by her and sometimes randomly by Coran that they need to remember their place. Like at one point, she actually envisions that after everything's well and good and they marry the princess off to someone, that they can just become like doormen in the castle.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's not what I would want.
No. No.
Okay, so at this point, we go back to Zarkon. He learns that they're looking for Sven's replacement, and he seeks help from Hagar. Mm-hmm. Well, Hagar tells him that her devil cat, Kova, and I think this is the first time they ever mention the cat's name,
right,
has completed a spell for a new roe beast. And she has a plan to attack Nanny while she's on her quest and lure the Voltron force to try to rescue her and then attack the force with the roe beast while they can't form Voltron.
Right.
At this point, the roe beast goes after the villages near the Crown Mountain. And it looks like I don't know if you noticed this or not, but it looked like the roe beast actually picked up some people and ate them. Did you see that?
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a famous moment in Go Lion as well. And yeah, the roe beast picks the guy up and eats him, and then Pidge is like, "Ugh, oh my gosh!" Like it's this moment on screen. Yeah.
Yeah, they see that in the control room. They see this on the video screen happening, and it just really frightens them. You know, they've never seen this.
Right.
And it reminds me of, have you seen Attack on Titan yet?
No, I've heard about it, but I haven't seen it.
This happens on Attack on Titan. Those big titans just reach down, grab people and eat them.
Right.
And it's a lot more worse, obviously, in Attack on Titan because sure. That was made for adults. But I had just imagined what it would have been like on Beast King Go Lion.
Uh-huh.
So the Voltron force immediately gets in the lions, and Coran tells the princess about the attack on Crown Mountain, and she wants to go help, but he ends up tying her up in a chair just to keep her there. And at this point, she's helpless. So while the nanny's running for cover, the lions attack the roe beast.
Uh-huh.
And they hit it from all sides. There's no damage. And while this is happening, the space mice in the castle, they free the princess from her ropes. And she gets blue line and goes to help. And they're able to immediately form Voltron with the princess for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they use the fire from Red Lion's mouth to fire the roe beast. And the roe beast is like, it looks like it's completely inflamed. And while that roe beast is stunned with that, then they form Blazing Sword. And then they split the roe beast in half. And at the end of the episode, Nanny asks her to promise that she'll never do it again, you know, be the Blue Lion pilot. But Princess refuses. That's never happening.
Right.
And then they all cheer for the princess and hold her up and throw her up and down and cheer. We've gotten to this point and we really think this is established now that the princess is going to be the Blue Lion pilot. For good, right?
Right.
It might not be the case if we take a look at the next episode.
Oh, yes, yes. The handsome dandy in the next episode.
So in episode 8, The Stolen Lion.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
The lions are training with the princess and Blue Lion. Everybody's okay with this right now. Of course, Coran and Nanny are still against this. But the rest of the force really, you know, likes the fact that she's willing to do this. And we've got Blue Lion and Red Lion in combat maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
And Lance is telling her that she's not moving fast enough.
Right.
Well, at one point, he ends up using Red Lion's mouth boomerang. And she gets hit with the boomerang, and she starts falling from the sky in Blue Lion.
Mm-hmm.
The others try to get to her, but there's no way that they're going to get to her in time. And it looks like she's going to fall to the ground. Well, another ship comes in out of nowhere, grabs Blue Lion in a tractor beam, and lowers it to the ground. So the team's wondering, who is this that saved her?
Right.
And a guy comes out of there, and he looks like the human equivalent of Lotor with white hair.
He's the prettiest man I ever saw.
Yeah. So, Nanny goes to the princess's side, and he identifies himself as Prince Bokar of Senac.
Yep.
And he says he was coming to Arras to look for a princess bride.
I was looking for Robin Wright when I thought I'd stop and see if everyone here had any idea where she was.
Well, of course, Lance sees right through this BS, right?
Of course, because he's Lance and he's awesome.
Yeah, and he challenges the prince, and then they start fighting.
Yeah, and you know, I won't give away any spoilers, but Lance's instincts are right on, and if he was my friend, I would trust him.
Right, but the princess ends up stopping the fight. And she thanks Prince Bokar for saving her life, first of all. And then they invite him as an honored guest. And Lance is still like, "Are you kidding me? What kind of prince goes riding around space by himself?"
Right.
You know, he's thinking practically here.
This episode starts a trend that happens throughout the rest of the series, and it's kind of frustrating. And Go Lion is no different. I mean, this is the plot of the original Go Lion show, so this isn't a knock against Voltron. This is just sort of a thing that happens on both incarnations of this series. But this is a trend where the people in the castle, the actual royals, or the not the royals, but the staff, Coran, Nanny, the princess,
Yeah.
they don't learn from their mistakes about strangers just showing up, offering to help.
Right.
And in Goliath, one of the things that is a catalyst for this is that whole thing I was talking about class warfare,
Right.
where when they're at that banquet in Voltron, right after this Prince Bokar saves her, they are all around the table eating or whatever, and even Pidge is kind of like, Nanny is just fawning all over this guy and talking about how wonderful he is, and they've just handed him the keys to the Blue Lion. He's known him 5 minutes. Like, it's very strange. And you know, Pidge says in the Go Lion episode, he says, "Why are you suddenly showing him all this favoritism and, you know, talking about how handsome he is and all this kind of stuff?" She's like, "Because he's royalty, and because he's, you know, a gentleman, and because he's this and that, and he deserves blah blah blah." Nanny is all about like class.
Right.
It's all it, there's no objectivity. It's like, "Oh, you're a prince, you deserve everything. You people, oh, you're from Earth, you deserve nothing."
Yeah, and that.
And yet they always, this is always their mistake, because these people are always evil.
Right. And they haven't even checked up on him to see if he really is a prince.
Yeah, they didn't even do a background check on him or anything. Like, they it's crazy. And this is a thing that happens throughout the rest of the series. You know, you've got episodes where the slave girl shows up and they want to help her, and then Coran's alleged son shows up and they want to help him. And you know, I think there's even another one that's like that, where they're just duped all the time, and the Earth pilots are always like, "Stop being stupid," and they're always like, "Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. Just shut up and go fly the lions when we need you to. Otherwise, be quiet."
Right.
It's kind of, it can be infuriating.
Right. So the thing that happens as soon as they get away from there, that she says, princess says, he can stay as long as he likes. They give him a feast. They raise glasses to him to toast him. And you know, of course, Lance can't believe all this is happening.
Right.
And at the meal, the space mice are stealing some food, and the nanny says she doesn't cook for mice. And of course, that's the lighthearted moment, which there aren't many in this one. But Hagar sees all of this happening in her little crystal ball.
Right.
She sees Bokar has won favor with the princess and that they're dining together. And then Zarkon reveals what the plan was, where Hagar trained Bokar to win her favor, then steal the Blue Lion and the princess and take them to Zarkon on Planet Doom, and then the universe will be his. So as they sleep that night, all of a sudden snakes start appearing in the vents, and they attack Lance because Bokar thought that Lance was his greatest threat at this point. The others go to help, and they attack the snakes, and they're able to conquer the snakes. And Bokar appears like he didn't know anything was going on. And, of course, they're saying, hey, there's cobras in the castle. This has never happened before. All of a sudden, it happens when he shows up. Okay, there's no coincidence here, but, of course, the princess and Karan stand firm. And they say that, you know, this couldn't have been Bokar that did this.
Well, it's also a lesson learned for anyone out there who's bothering to pay attention.
Uh-huh.
That is, when you go to bed at night and you put on your pajamas, you need to carry a dagger. Because everybody who wakes up in the castle and runs over there is in their PJs except for the new prince guy. They all run out to Lance's room to find out what's going on. And, okay, it's feasible to think that Lance has a dagger near his bedside somewhere where he can start defending himself against the snakes, right?
Sure.
But Keith and Hunk and Pidge all whip daggers out of their underoos, and they just start going to town. It's like, wow, I wouldn't have thought to grab my dagger before I ran down the hallway, you know?
Right, but...
Kudos to you.
But how often does Lance cry out for help?
True. True.
That does not happen very often.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, so... They start accusing Bokar of bringing the snakes and everything and trying to sabotage everything. And at the point, Karan and Princess are still sticking up for him. And then, like you said before, all of a sudden, it's like almost like they were hypnotized. They offer Bokar to replace Sven in Blue Lion, and then they give him the key. It just seemed like the strangest thing at the time for that to be happening. And like you said, in Golion, there's a different thing going on there behind the scenes that we don't see.
Right.
So, wow. Pidge and Keith and Hunk and Lance, are you crazy? What are you talking about? Princess can be the Blue Lion.
Yeah.
So at that point, they start seeing something coming out of Bokar's arm. Well, it's a snake. And now Bokar's secret is out, you know. So even though the nanny was protecting him and Karan was protecting him, the princess was protecting him, he grabs the princess. She faints.
Mm-hmm.
And he just throws her over his shoulder and takes her to the Blue Lion in handcuffs.
Right.
So he's trying to start Blue Lion, but he can't start Blue Lion. And then all of a sudden you hear Alfor's voice saying, you will never get the power of Voltron.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, the princess had woken up and she heard her father's voice.
Right.
So Bokar says to Princess Allura, you need to get in here and start Blue Lion for me. And of course, she refuses to help him, but he forces her to start Blue Lion. Keith, who's gotten, you know, out there with the lions and everything, says, do whatever he says. So she starts Blue Lion, and they start getting out and out of the water and everything. And what the other lions do, because they don't want to hurt the princess or Blue Lion, they just sort of knock him around. Bokar falls into one part of the cockpit, and then all of a sudden he turns into like a snake man.
Uh huh.
So you can see where where this whole snake theme came from. Princess quickly opens the hatch, and he flies out. At this point, Urak activates a ray that turns Bokar into a robeast, a large robeast.
Right.
And the princess and the rest of the Voltron force, they form Voltron. This is the first time that we ever see a robeast that talks.
Yeah, and if you for anyone out there listening who's just, you know, likes funny, curious, weird stuff, if you take a screenshot of Bokar as the Robeast, and then you go and watch the G.I. Joe miniseries, The Weather Dominator, the Revenge of Cobra is the official title of it. There's a moment where they are in South America, Flint and Lady J and Gung-Ho, and they're inside like a pyramid. Actually, it's not Flint, it's Shipwreck and Gung-Ho and Lady J. They're inside this pyramid trying to get this one piece of the Weather Dominator, and Cobra sends in these robots, these huge robots, to try and stop them. Those robots look exactly like Bokar as the Robeast.
Wow.
Like they both look, yeah, it's pretty funny.
Do you think they stole it?
Nah, I think it's just a weird coincidence, 'cause how many different ways can you make a cobra-headed robot?
Right.
So,
That's true.
yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, like I said, this is the first time we see a Robeast that talks, and he doesn't end up talking for long, even though he sounds formidable and everything, and he's still got that attitude that Bokar had. We see some new things happening here. They do a thing called the Electro Force from the crest on Voltron's chest, and it comes straight out of the chest of Voltron, and it goes towards the Snake Man Robeast, Bokar, and it doesn't do anything really. They form Blazing Sword, and then they blast fire from Red Lion's mouth, and then they slice him with a sword and he explodes. So that whole sequence of those moves all at once, and it totally destroyed that Robeast.
Right.
And of course, Yorak, he has to head back to Doom in shame. But
As usual.
the one thing that happens at the end of this whole episode, Princess swears she will never be fooled again by another man unless she wants it to happen.
Watch me carefully so that it will never happen again. Unless I want it to.
Did you get that part?
Yeah, I got that part.
And
Yeah.
at the time that she's saying that, there's like all these glittery crystals that are emanating all around her head and all this kind of stuff, and they make it like, oh, unless I want to fall in love with somebody.
Right.
You
Right.
know? So you get little hints here about, you know, I wonder who this man is that's going to woo her and win her over. So, I don't know. It was just, that was a little bit of a premonition of what could happen in the future.
Sure.
So I guess we get the idea later on that Keith is the only one that's going to win her heart.
Eventually, sometime down the road, if we
Right.
ever actually see it,
Right.
it's all assumed.
But that was a little foreshadowing of what could happen later.
Yep.
So this is where we're going to stop our episode for the week. And we just talked about the now we're up to 8 episodes that we've talked about from the original series.
Right.
And I want you and I want everybody in the Let's Voltron listening family to know that next week we are going to have a special guest that it's probably going to be another two-part episode, so the next 2 episodes will be filled with our next guest. And his name is Franklin Kofod. Franklin Kofod was the original director of the original series, and he was also a producer, and he was also part of the editing team, and I mean, he did basically everything. He was the showrunner for the show. So we are going to be interviewing Franklin Kofod next week, and we would like you guys to send in your questions this week. So what we would like is if you could either give us a Facebook message or a Twitter post or call us on our voicemail at 860-4-MULLET, MULLET. So give us a voicemail call. Send us messages on Let's Voltron or the Facebook page. And, give us your questions for Franklin Kofod, because remember when we had Mark Handler on, he taught us everything from the writer's perspective about what happened in the original series. Well, with Franklin Kofod, you're going to get the whole package because he was there from the beginning when they made the first pilot that they had to sell to the broadcasters for the Voltron series. He was basically Peter Keefe's right-hand man. So everything that happened in the Voltron series, you'll get all of that information from Franklin Kofod. So what do you think about that, Mike?
It's pretty sharp. I mean, there aren't many opportunities to get this kind of depth of information in a section this long. I mean, we all know that you know, DVD special features on even the most comprehensive DVDs still just have sound bites cut together from different sources to create sort of a 15-minute package. So to have a two-hour interview with just one of those major contributors to the original Voltron is something for the archives. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we wish we had from, you know, actors, directors, writers that have passed on for a lot of different properties. So this is good stuff.
Right. And we know that Peter Keefe had passed away in 2010, and he was really the mastermind behind everything that happened with the Voltron series. But for us to be able to get 2 hours with Franklin Kofod, who had everything to do with that show, it's just going to be an amazing thing to hear.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we are looking forward to next week very much. We will be posting on our Facebook, on our Twitter, and Let's Voltron about that next episode, and we will be asking for your questions again. So join us next week on Let's Voltron.